So, Steve, hit me with this, right? Because this is one of these, like, mental health mythological statements I keep hearing all over the place, including from you, actually, if I may be so bold to say
you
so.
You may. Guilty
yeah,
as charged.
Thank you. Thank you for the permission. I've heard you say, and other people like you, say that movement is medicine, right? And I'm like,
Movement is medicine.
That makes sense. I kind of buy into that. But then you hear people being like, well, food is medicine and sleep is medicine. I'm like, okay. Everything can't be medicine. Okay, guys? Like, you have to limit your medicine cabinet here. But hit us with your sell for why movement really is medicine and give us a wee tiny bit about that.
Is movement? Yeah, sounds a little woo-woo. Sounds a little hyperbolic.
Yeah.
And all these online influencers say annoying crap like that all the time, right? And you're like, okay, credibility shot already. So I've been known to say movement is medicine, as you know.
Well, I mean, you are an internet influencer, so you were just talking about yourself when you said that.
pretty much. Yeah. I'm just going to skip right over that. So is it just metaphor? Is it just hyperbole? What the hell does it really mean? So here's what I'd say. If you could take all of the biological effects of exercise and capture it in a pill, if there were a medicine that we could buy that would do for our bodies, that would do for our brains, exactly what regular physical activity would do, what regular exercise would do, it would overnight become the best-selling medication of all time. So I'm going to go for my pill. We're going to call it Exerzac. And it's like, okay, well, what is this going to do? It will have robust antidepressant effects. It will improve sleep quality. So it will help with insomnia. It will help with anxiety. If I have panic attacks, it has a pretty good likelihood of reducing the frequency of panic. It's going to help with brain fog. It's going to help with attention deficit problems. It's going to help, of course, physiologically, in terms of my overall health, for an old guy like me, older guy like me, it's going to reduce the risk. It's going to reduce my blood pressure. It's going to help improve cholesterol profile. Here's my favorite part. It has anti-aging effects. It literally slows down aging at the level of our cellular mitochondria, at the level of DNA expression. It's absolutely wild. We haven't mentioned to our viewers, our listeners, that I'm actually 87 and, you know, really don't look a day over.
I'm going to have to cut you off here, man. This is where you're veering into like snake oil salesman territory. Right, I'm like listening to all this and I'm like, have we become the very thing that we set out to destroy? Like, I'm thinking back to like some of our early episodes where, I mean, you beautifully just went off on kind of some of the tactics that Big Pharma uses to promote some of these drugs. And, you know, time and time again, we've said there's no such thing as like a magic pill. There's no such thing as like one size fits all medicine. And yet you've just spent the last like 2 minutes like listing out this thing does absolutely everything that you could possibly imagine.
Yeah. Thank you for that helpful caveat. What I would say is for the average person, done wisely, physical movement has all of these potential benefits. It's not a panacea. It's not curative for everyone's ailments across the board, for everything. For some people, it is genuinely miraculous. But what I will say is our bodies are meant to be moving. Our bodies are designed to be moving. And most people in the 21st century in the affluent Western world are very sedentary. And being sedentary is toxic. So it makes sense that if we can get people moving again the way they're designed to be living, that the benefits are going to be just off the charts. And so we're going to dive into the weeds. We're going to unpack that a bit. But I think that's a nice setup, at least, for kind of what the landscape is about to look like.
Awesome. Love it. Well, let's just jump in then. Hello. Welcome to Mental Health, the show where we discuss the latest tools, the ancient practices, and some of the cutting-edge research to help you take back control of your emotional well-being. My name's Hugh James. I'm a writer and a podcaster from Ireland who has been in recovery from addiction and depression over the last 15 years.
That is just so smooth and professional, Hugh James.
I mean, we haven't actually done this for a couple of weeks, so I was like having to like be like, wait, what comes first? Like, what do I usually say? Because like, you get in such a groove of saying it, and you notice you like you switch into like your phone voice, where you're like, "Hello, Hugh James here. Yes, can I take your order, please?" You know what I mean? It's just like things that you could just like pull out of your back pocket because you say it so often.
It was beautifully done. Yeah, the only thing I didn't hear was if I wanted fries with that. But no. But I kid. So, hey, everybody, I'm Steve Ilardi. Like, you know, it's funny with my students. They're like, what do we call you? And I'm like, well, oh, good question. You can call me if you'd like. You can call me Dr. Ilardi. You can call me Professor Ilardi. If you got enough swagger, though, you can call me Steve. Okay. So you, dear listener, you are more than welcome to refer to me as Steve. I'm a psychologist. I'm trained as a neuroscientist. I am a licensed psychotherapist. You know, mostly I'm a fellow traveler, and I'm honored to be with you all.
Awesome. So this episode is part of our ongoing series. We're kind of loosely labeling the essentials, which is where we're taking a look at some of the most important tools that you can have in your mental health toolkit to prevent, treat, and manage just about any mental health disorder that you or a loved one may be experiencing. These are the things that Steve and I sat down one day and we're like, right, if people could only do, say, a handful of things, and if we could only put out like 10 episodes and then we would literally disappear off the face of the planet, these are the things that we would like to leave behind for anyone who is on any sort of a journey with their mental health. So Steve, you've done an excellent job so far of selling us on exercise. Lead us down the kind of sales funnel a little bit more, like bring us with some of that like scientific facts. You know, my salespeople, they always hit you with like some data and stuff. Like, give us a wee bit of science to kind of sweeten the deal.
Yeah. So let's start with the big picture. And that is, as we've talked about many times on this show, our species, humanity, our ancestors for hundreds of thousands of years were living, basically making their living as hunters, gatherers, living in these small clans of 30, 50, 150 people on a lifelong camping trip together. And their lives were extraordinarily rich with movement, with activity. How do we know? Well, we can study modern day Aboriginal groups that live, you know, pretty similar lives. What do we find? It varies a bit from one location to the next. But on average, we find they're moving vigorously 3 to 4 hours a day. Doing what? Well, stalking prey.
Hunting, gathering, you know, hunting, gathering. The usual.
Yeah, the usual. They do a lot of lifting, though. It's like if you ran into a hunter-gatherer and said, hey, do you lift, bro? It'd be like, well, actually, yeah.
So like, okay, like give me like a deadlift. Like what is a hunter-gatherer deadlifting? Like I was going to say like a dead deer or something. Yeah, they're just like overhead pressing it. They're like, yay!
Yeah, but how about the insanely heavy logs that they use often to erect their dwellings? And then don't even get me started on lugging water and forth.
Of course.
So their lives are filled with what we would now call cardio, right? Running and all kinds of like aerobic activity, but also anaerobic resistance sort of training. And balance and, you know, endurance and stretching. And, oh, by the way, lots of fun as well. So, a lot of the movement they're doing, I don't want us to think of it as drudgery because, you know, a lot of it would actually, we would find really engaging, immersive, enjoyable. And they do a lot of, most Aboriginal societies that have been studied, they have a lot of ceremonial recreation, ceremonial dance. They'll have like these sort of marathon hypnotic sort of dance rituals that'll go on for hours into the night. I mean, really genuinely life-changing for people. You know, we may unpack that a little bit as well. They may or may not involve mind-altering substances. It turns out, though, that even very lengthy, repetitive movement in a community can have kind of consciousness-altering effects. Even when we're stone cold sober, there's a kind of thing that happens with the brain's endorphins and endocannabinoids with ritual lengthy activity that can be genuinely spiritually transformative. So when we look at our Aboriginal brothers and sisters and we look at their lives and it's like, yeah, they're really hard. They don't have any of our modern conveniences or medicine or anything else. they're living, in many respects, a lifestyle that our bodies and brains are still pretty well adapted for. And the big takeaway is that they're moving all the time. Not all the time, but they're moving a lot. They also rest a lot, for sure. But they're not nearly as sedentary as we are. And there's this huge array of biochemical changes that happen in the body, that happen in the brain whenever we're moving, especially when we're moving vigorously. But when we're moving at all, basically our bodies are saying, oh, yeah, this is exactly what we're designed for. And now let's put in place all the kinds of changes that match the challenge of the moment. And it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to give a quick analogy and I promise we're going to move on. Whenever we have astronauts that spend any time in outer space, like up at the space station or on the moon or whatever, they're in zero gravity. So there's no stress or challenge on their bones because, you know, just holding up your body weight while you're walking, even sitting a bit, but there's a lot of stress and challenge on our bones that they're designed to be handling all the time. And they are looking for that feedback of like, oh, femur pounding into pavement, holding up, you know, forces of hundreds of pounds. And what happens when astronauts get back from extended stays in zero gravity? They've lost massive amounts of bone tissue. Their bones start to demineralize because they're not getting the signal. They're not getting the stress that they're designed for that they need in order to have optimal function. And that's kind of like, think of it, this is a very dramatic sort of image, but I want you to think of, and I want our listeners to think of, if they're being sedentary, if they're being couch potatoes 24/7, 365, they're kind of like these astronauts that are out in zero gravity.
Ooh, their bodies, I like where you took that. Yes.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I'm not even doing material here. That was just off.
Are you riding on stage currently? You're just like freeballing.
Yeah. And without the benefit of, well, a live audience of one, I guess. But two, because Teddy the Wonder Dog is nearby. So yeah, that image works for me, right? It's like, okay, just like astronauts have these horrifically bad changes to their bodies when they're not getting put through the paces that they're designed for. They're designed for gravity. Our bodies are not designed for this sedentary life. Our ancestors never would have been able to stay alive for a year being this sedentary. We can, but it's not good for us.
You ever seen the movie WALL-E, the Pixar movie?
I have seen WALL-E. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, so like, you know, the writers were having like a bit of a jab at like modern humans. You know, the spaceship opens up and they're all like severely obese and kind of soft looking. And obviously, like, if you compare us to hunter-gatherers, even like 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, it's kind of like the same metaphor. It's like we've become like these soft physical versions of ourselves that is kind of like, I don't know, maybe this is just like a guy thing, but like, it's a little bit embarrassing. Like when you were talking about like the dude, like deadlifting the logs earlier, I was like, I go to the gym twice a week.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. And I don't want to gloss over. It's like, all right. So just really quickly for viewers, for listeners, until about 10,000 years ago, everybody on the planet was part of a hunter-gatherer group, or some were fishing, but I mean, analogously, they were not raising their food. They were catching their food, finding their food. 10,000 years ago, roughly, we had the agrarian revolution. So now there was a pivot. And over the next 10,000 years, most of humanity switched from hunter-gatherer to farming, herding livestock, you know, and so forth. And so I live in the center of the U.S. in a very agricultural area. I mean, I'm in a college town outside of Kansas City, which is a major city. But all around us are people who make their living as agrarians, right? They're farming. And I teach a lot of these young men and women who come to the university off the farm. And
you want to know what we call those people, by the way?
What do you call them?
We call them culchies.
Culchies.
Don't ask me why. That's just what we call people from the country.
Okay, we got to track down the etymology of Northern Irish culchies. It doesn't have to be on this episode, but at some point. So what I was going to say is, okay, so these are agrarians. They're not hunter-gatherers, but they still stand out among their suburban, city-dwelling, suburban-urban, college-age peers because they have a kind of physical robustness
Dude, the Colchis were always the best at rugby. They were absolutely like the strongest dudes on the planet because they were like picking up tractors from they were like 3 years old. You're like, what the heck? You're like a superhuman.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is something beautiful about this idea, right? That we are a little bit like those astronauts. We are a little bit like the characters in WALL-E. And it doesn't mean that we have to jettison all the things that we love about modernity. I love a lot. I love being able to do this podcast, this YouTube.
What would we be doing without this? We would be like around a campfire at midnight to an audience of 20. It does sound pretty good though, in fairness.
Yeah, I'm such an optimist, and I know you are as well. I genuinely, part of my mission in life is for myself and my loved ones and anyone that I can influence, my students, my patients, and our listeners and viewers, to hold out the idea that we can have the best of both worlds. We can reclaim the healing habits of the past and weave them into the fabric of day-to-day life in the present. And so, you know, I believe we can live our lives in the 21st century in a way that preserves so much of the beauty and the benefit of the lifestyle that our ancestors lived. And so for a lot of us, that's going to mean we got to get our bodies moving. And the paradox, of course, is that we also come with this Stone Age software in our brains that says, hey, dude, the last thing you want to do is exercise. The last thing you want to do, you know, because when we look at modern day Aboriginal groups, what do we find? They cherish the opportunity to be lazy. Because they're right on the edge of overtraining a lot of the time. They're right on the edge of like their body's limit.
But also the concept of like going into an indoor environment and picking up heavy pieces of metal is not something they would be interested in. Because they're like, dude, I'm not wasting my calories on exactly trying to hit my next deadlift PR, bro. Like, I got to go out and hunt later.
I love the way you put that. And so what do we find? We need to find a way to basically overcome our Stone Age software, which says, be as lazy as you possibly can to save calories, while we're living in this 21st century post-industrial landscape that has engineered the need for physical movement completely out of modern life. So that if we want to be as lazy as possible, which our brain is telling us most of the time, be as lazy as you can, we look at a piece of exercise equipment with a feeling of dread in the pit of our stomach, right? We're looking at that treadmill. We're looking at that row machine. We're looking at the, you know, whatever the, we're looking at that stack of weights. And there's a sense of dread because the circuits of our brain, those ancient circuits are saying, dude, you're not going anywhere. You're not going anywhere on that thing. This has no purpose, no significance, no meaning. So why would you waste your calories? Why would you waste your energy?
So then let's do this. Let's give our software, let's give our brain a couple of layers of meaning to something like a treadmill or to something like going to the gym. Or hopefully, I think we'll talk about this later on, like doing something outdoors, because I mean, that's much more fun. But you know, so we kind of need to, not necessarily artificially, but in some ways, need to artificially manufacture meaning and attach meaning to these things to kind of at least convince the little puppy dog brain to like do a trick for us. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we can definitely, I think everybody knows that exercise is good for them, right? Everybody knows that exercise is good for their physical health. I think a lot of people, though, don't quite realize how powerful it is for mental health. So let's review that really quickly, since this is, after all, the mental health podcast. So if we could take our pill of Exerzac, if we could get these...
Good callback, Stephen. Good callback. Come on. Come on. This is a six-month-old podcaster here. You can tell the reps are showing.
Oh, I've done the reps, brother. So if we could take our Exerzac, what's it going to do for our mental health? Well, exercise... And by the way, pretty low dose of exercise. We're going to maybe unpack this a little bit in a minute, but we're talking about basically aerobic or cardio level, brisk walking. So really, you know, walking like you're late for the bus, walking like you might miss your flight or something. So you're moving like you mean it, but you're not running. 30 minutes in that aerobic range, and that just aerobic range basically means you're really making your heart and your lungs work pretty hard. So you're kind of breathing pretty hard. 30 minutes in that range, three times a week, head to head against a drug we call here in the US, Zoloft. The chemical name is sertraline. I don't know how it's marketed in other countries.
It's sertraline, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Okay, so it's, you know, a typical SSRI antidepressant. And this study has been done and replicated. It's been done twice. Very, very high level of rigor methodologically. Middle-aged, severely depressed patients, randomly assigned to get some brisk walking, so 30 minutes three times a week, or getting their sertraline Zoloft. And at the end of the trial, typically these med trials for depression or anxiety last about 3 months. At the end of the trial, by the way, there's a placebo control condition, which we want to have. And at the end of the trial, both the drug group and the walking group beat placebo. No difference between them, except at the follow-up, which was done 6 months later, those who were exercising had better outcomes than those who only took a medication. And so, I mean, this is powerful. So, mental health benefit of exercise, brain chemicals that people have heard about, serotonin, dopamine, a neural growth hormone called BDNF, which we've talked about on previous episodes. We're not going to talk about too much today, but neuroplasticity, the ability to grow new memories, the ability to be mentally clear. So clinical depression, anxiety drops, insomnia typically will drop as long as, especially if we're not exercising right before bedtime or within a couple hours of bedtime, it has a benefit for insomnia. People who suffer from panic episodes or what are colloquially referred to as anxiety attacks, in the business, we call them panic attacks. The frequency, intensity, duration of panic tends to drop with aerobic activity. ADHD symptoms tend to improve with Exerzac.
I think we talked about this in ADHD 101. Like, I'm not on the ADHD spectrum. It's not one of the areas I struggle with. I've got some other things going on. But I even find as someone who classically has quite a good level of focus and is able to kind of like muster up all that, exercise just takes it to the next level. Like, I am so clear, I'm so focused, I'm so much easier to fight against distraction whenever I have like that type of exercise that you're talking about in my life. So it's nice because that pretty much anyone can kind of get that benefit as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just thinking about the fact that when we look at people who are sleep deprived, and we're going to have an episode on sleep here shortly, but people who are sleep deprived, when they take a stimulant, they will get benefit. So if they don't have ADHD, they don't have any attentional problems. When the brain is sleep deprived, they start to be a little bit more in that ADHD space. And then the stimulant can help mask that deficit. Well, guess what? Exercise can do the same thing. So in other words, if you take somebody who does not have attention problems typically, but maybe they didn't get quiet enough sleep, if they do an intense workout, then they get a similar kind of, oh, we're going to mask any mental deficit that might have ensued due to sleep deprivation. It's really interesting, especially if they do the workout in the morning. So finally, let's talk about brain aging, brain fog, dementia. Regular movement is hugely protective against brain aging, against the, you know, people when as they age, the typical aging curve we think of, people say in their 60s as being maybe not quite as quick, not quite as sharp, not quite as much on their neurocognitive A game. And certainly by the time they get up in their 70s and 80s. And, you know, we think of it as like, oh, it's just inevitable. It's normal brain aging. Just like we think of, oh, it's inevitable. Your body is going to basically, you're going to lose all kinds of muscle mass and break down as you age. Well, it's not inevitable. And if we stay moving throughout middle age and beyond, then we can, I mean, father time is undefeated. I'm not saying, I don't want to overpromise here, but I think if most of us, if we think about the people that we know who have aged really gracefully, they are usually people who have continued really working out, just staying active throughout their lives. So,
and
yeah.
Kind of on that, you know, the brain aging and the dementia piece, this is anecdotal. I've got no studies for you, which is, you know, classic Hugh. But you know Peter Attia, right? You're probably
of course,
a
yeah.
Pete
fan. I don't know him, but I'm very familiar with his work.
Yeah, I remember listening to his podcast a few years ago, and he was saying that he just became really interested in dementia and Alzheimer's. he assigned like one of his research team, like take like a long period of time. Like it was an extensive period of time. He's like, go away and find me like the number one thing that can prevent dementia. And they went away and they came back and they said exercise. And he said he was so pissed off that it was so simple. He literally sent them out again. He goes, no, find me something better. And they went out again and they came back. They're like, bro, I'm so sorry. Like, it's exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's really funny because in our therapeutic lifestyle change, our TLC program for treating clinical depression, we have six different components. And six different elements of ranging from, a lot of our longtime listeners know, omega-3 supplementation and habits of healthy sleep and bright light therapy and movement and a lot of elements. And we have had many, many, many patients over the years that have asked like, okay, well, if you just had to pick one to focus on. And I'm like, well, first of all, the whole idea is you don't want to just pick one. We need to do all the things. Once we take mental illness seriously, we get unstuck from the idea that there's going to be a single magic bullet that's going to work for everybody. But if you had to focus
I love
on
that,
one.
But if I had to.
If I had to. Had to
I can just
one.
Imagine, like, you know, the students holding you at gunpoint. You're like, please don't make me say this, but I have to.
I have to. The evidence for the psychoactive benefit of exercise, the research, is so much stronger than the evidence in terms of the actual magnitude of the effect for anything else that we do. It's truly stunning and it's kind of breathtaking. And by the way, back to, if we can call back to a point we made earlier, that's not what people want to hear. Because to a lot of people, as we said earlier, exercise is like a four-letter word. Right? I mean, exercise, it's like, oh God, like anything other than that, because it feels like such drudgery. It feels like such effort. And by the way, when people are suffering from any form of psychological distress, any form of mental suffering, the last thing they want to do is push out of their comfort zone. And so what we need to do really is, I think, not so much convince people that exercise is beneficial. Although I do think, yeah, absolutely, we need to have the right motivation. But once people are convinced, we need to set them up for success. We need to find a way for all of us to basically hack our motivational circuitry, which is working against us. And let's just be honest, for most of us, honest with the fact about the fact that we don't really want to exercise, but we desperately need to be moving.
Yeah.
And so we need to kind of reverse engineer our motivational system and find little hacks that will allow us to joyfully embrace this opportunity to do something that once we make it a habit and once we figure it out, we actually can find it pretty, like really one of the more enjoyable things in our life for most
Absolutely.
Of us, I would say.
And do you know what's really helped me, you know, as longtime listeners know, like, you know, I read your book, The Depression Cure, a few years ago and totally turned my life around and transformed how I battle my own depression and how I manage it, how I treat it, the whole shebang. And the type of individual I am, what really works incredibly well for me is to have a very, very clear box that I can tick. And so the reason why The Depression Cure works so well for me is it's like, particularly with exercise, like here's a really defined box. 3 times a week, you have to do 30 minutes of intense exercise to the point where you would struggle to have a conversation with the person next to you. That's the level of intensity. Your heart rate is very high. Steve can give us the exact kind of percentage here in a minute. But that has been so helpful for me because on my best weeks, I breeze through that and I tick the box. And then I say, dude, let's also play basketball. Let's also do this. Let's also do that. On my worst weeks, and I'm not talking about overtraining, I'm not talking about forcing yourself beyond your limits, but on the weeks whenever I am feeling that sluggishness or I feel that kind of like early stage of depression, those 3 sessions become like a handrail that I'm clawing towards, but I tick the box and every time I do it, it makes me feel unbelievable. And so I love that approach because a lot of people will tell you like, ah, well, here's what you got to do. You got to start doing CrossFit and you also need to do P90X. And, you know, have you considered taking up professional street basketball while you're at it? And you're like, dude, like not happening, especially if you are already in that depressed state where for anyone listening who's there, you know what we're talking about here. You don't even want to get out of bed. You don't even want to get a shower. Like, the thought of doing climbing a mountain is just out of your realm of imagination right now. So having that relatively low bar is so helpful. And what I love about it is to get your heart rate pumping is so individual specific. For some
it
people
is, yeah.
listening, it's going to be a brisk walk. For other people listening, if you have like a decent level of fitness going into this, it's going to require a little bit more, but I'd love for you to speak to that.
Yeah, thank you. In fact, I was just making some mental notes as you were talking. All great stuff. But because you're young and you're in very good physical shape, for you, you're going to have to get your heart rate way up there. So the word, by the way, let me just lay my cards on the table. For most forms of psychological benefit, and we're talking about, again, anti-anxiety effects, anti-ADHD effects, antidepressant effects, anti-aging effects, anti-brain fog effects, anti-panic effects. We're talking about, the best evidence says, something cardio, something aerobic, roughly 30 minutes or so, three times a week. So that's a total of 90 minutes a week. If you ask, well, can I break it up in, what if I want to do 5 days a week, 20 minutes-ish? Absolutely. That seems to be fine. If you wanted to do 2 45-minute blocks, probably. If you want to do 1 90-minute block, probably not. That's going to be overtraining for most people. Too much, too long for most people. But here's the thing. Aerobic simply means getting your heart and your lungs challenged to the point where they're having to work pretty hard. How hard? Well, that's going to depend on your age and your level of fitness. But the rule of thumb, or if I can use a fancy professor word, can I use it? You ready? The heuristic, the mental rule of thumb, is, as Hugh just said, when you're aerobic, you're breathing pretty hard. And you can carry on a conversation if you're working out with somebody else. And by the way, I would recommend most of us, if we can, possibly make it social. That's going to really help for all kinds of reasons that we'll get into. You can carry on a conversation, but it's not going to be effortless. It's like you kind of have to sort of pause for a breath here and there.
Oh, that's what it was. It was, you can't sing. I can't tell you. That's in your book. And I can't tell you how often I've been out for a run. And I'll just start singing a little bit. And I'm like, oh, no, I got to crank it up.
Yeah, yeah. If you can have the breath control, by the way, term of art for those who sing. If you can have the breath control to get out a full phrase of whatever tune you happen to have in your head, then you're not aerobic. You're just not. You need to step it up a little bit. But let me give a disclaimer on the other side, which is you don't want to be panting for breath. The goal here is not to push people right to the very limit. So there's another form of activity called high intensity interval training. And the goal with HIIT is you're going as fast, as hard as you possibly can for short bursts of like 10 to 30 seconds, maybe a minute.
And those workouts are like between 5 and 10 minutes long. We're talking about like, you got to sustain this for 30, if not 35 minutes.
Yeah, exactly right. So one other little, I guess, disclaimer is that a lot of people, I would say this happens more with men than women, but you see it with both sexes. A lot of people really prefer weightlifting or some sort of resistance kind of activity. And I get asked all the time, well, does that have psychological benefit? Can that have antidepressant effects? The answer is yes. But the best evidence is you want to try to make that activity aerobic. So when you're weightlifting or doing resistance training for mental health benefit, then you're not doing it for maximal muscle gain. So in other words, you're not going to break for 3 minutes between sets. You're going to break for maybe 15, 20 seconds and then go right. So if you're in a gym, this would be like circuit training or something where you just go boom, boom, boom from one activity to the next.
And I think that's why I prefer for my antidepressant exercise to do something that's steady state because there's no risk. I don't need to think about, am I taking too many breaks? Am I timing everything properly? It's like, no, no, no. You're cycling for 30 minutes or you are running for 30 minutes or you're on the stair machine or Jacob's ladder or whatever other thing I'm doing that week. And it's uninterrupted. The timer's on. I see when it's done. Tick the box. Thank you for my feel good hormones. I'm going on to the rest of my day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. One last little thing to say, since we're talking about the dose of exercise, right? The dose. So how much, how long, frequency, intensity, duration, how frequent? For most of us, 3 times a week is going to be just fine. By the way, does that mean we can't exercise more than 3 days a week? No, absolutely. I personally try to go 5 or 6 days a week. But if I had been clinically depressed and were shut down, I would aim for the antidepressant dose, which notice is more modest. It's a lower dose than most medical associations would recommend, than the CDC recommends, and the American Heart Association recommends. It's a fairly low dose. But the one thing I did want to say is it takes most of us, if I'm brisk walking and I want to get my heart rate up into that zone where like I can't sing and I might get a little bit sweaty, especially if it's not cold out, it's going to take me 5 to 10 minutes to get there. So in other words, don't start your timer for about 10 minutes or so. So you're really going to set aside 40 minutes for your walk, the first 10 minutes to get up into the aerobic zone. And you'll know, again, because it's hard to sing or it's hard to carry on an easy conversation. So yeah, but we're still talking about basically 120 minutes a week, 2 hours out of your week to do something, hopefully that'll be enjoyable, hopefully social. We'll talk about how to opt just a sec.
That's cool. So when I hadn't planned to share this today. I just want to throw out a quick thing here. My dad's actually using it at the minute, and it's really great. I know tons of people that have used it. It's a UK-based app. It's called Couch to 5K. It's run by the NHS.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And why they called it couch instead of sofa is just, I don't know, it's a mortal sin to anyone who's from this part of the world, but they did it anyway. And it's awesome. It's a guided audio program that will take you from a couch potato to running a 5K. It might be 12 weeks, it might be 6 months, I'm not entirely sure. But every workout is just guided for you. You stick the headphones in and you walk out the door and you just do what you're told from there. And again,
I love it.
I love that. Like, I just love the simplicity of it. I know for me, I rely on programs and things like that to follow somewhat mindlessly. I put a lot of thought in at the start of it to make sure it's okay, yeah, I'm on board with this. This makes sense. Once my decision is made, I want something that I can just like fall out the door into. And so if you are coming from a place of you haven't done any exercise for a long period of time, that could be something useful for you to check out. There's tons of other things like it. You don't have to use that one, obviously. But I do want to talk about some of the...
Can I just say one more thing about that? I think it's so important.
Of course.
Thank you. So I've worked with a lot of patients who have been really sedentary for a long time. And there is no way that they can jump into a 40-minute brisk walk on the first day without either hurting themselves, overtraining to the point where what's overtraining? Just pushing your body too hard to the point where, here's a quick little rule of thumb. If you feel worse at the end of your walk, at the end of your run, at the end of your lifting, at the end of your Zumba class, at the end of your cycling, if you feel worse at the end than you did when you started, you've overtrained. If you feel sluggish and lethargic for the next several hours, if you are working out, doing something regularly, and you feel like you're more fatigued, that you just are sluggish all the time, that's a sign that you're pushing too hard. So if you are out there listening and you've been very sedentary for a long period of time, first thing you want to do, probably talk with your doctor or your healthcare provider and just make sure that there's no physical reason why you can't get more physically active. For 90%+ of listeners, that's not going to be an issue, but I have to put that disclaimer. Secondly, start slow. Just give yourself a really easy goal of like 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I have a close relative who had a really debilitating illness some time ago, and she was a healthy young woman before, but she was bedridden for about 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks of being bedridden, she was out of breath walking across the room. And so I helped her get back to get reconditioned, but it took about 3 weeks of just pushing a little further every time. And I think some of us are going to need to really remind ourselves, be patient, give your body time to really ramp up and tolerate this kind of activity.
Yeah. And something that you have prescribed in the past that I think is really powerful if people have the means to do so is like hiring a personal trainer. Like there's no better way to like add that level of accountability, because there is that weird phenomenon where like whatever you spend money on, you all of a sudden value it a lot more. So there's that, like, it makes you more likely to do it. But also, if you've got someone like showing up at your front door to go on that walk with you, you can also outsource this to a friend if you have the community around
Absolutely.
You and the people that would do that. That would obviously be the preferred option. But if you don't, and if you have the means to do so, like a personal trainer can be a really great way to pretty much almost guarantee that you're going to hit those three slots every single week, at least as an on-ramp, at least as a start, at least as a way to enter yourself into this really powerful habit that really genuinely has the potential to change your life.
Absolutely, yeah. And I know two people here in my college town who had a real concern, a real heart for people in the community who don't have a lot of money, can't afford a trainer, maybe don't have the sort of dear friend who would be willing to partner with them and get them to this place of beneficial physical activity. And so one of them started something at his church where a group of folks would just meet at, 7:30 in the morning, maybe 7, sometime around there, where they would just meet. People didn't have to be a part of this church. They could just, anybody in the community, the word got out that they were just going to meet and support each other and go for this aerobic walk together. And for those for whom walking at that pace was not aerobic, they would put on like ankle weights or just carry something, put on a backpack.
Yeah.
You know, if you're carrying enough weight, you can make walking at any speed pretty aerobic. There's another guy who was a trainer with the athletic department at my university. And when he retired, he started it almost looks like something out of, I don't even know. It looks surreal, but it's basically a group of thousands of people from the community who are coming together in a big open field doing.
That is like kind of big, crazy.
It looks like a cult. I'm not going to
lie.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It's like, is this Falun Gong? Is what's happening here? But no, it's just a bunch of randos from Kansas that are out in a field doing communal activity, and it's free. So I would just say, you know, look, don't let money be a barrier.
Yeah.
Don't let isolation be a barrier, because there are people out there who do care, who probably, if you're willing to look just a little bit, you can connect with someone in your community.
For sure.
Who will help you get moving.
A couple of other kind of quick tools off the back of that. Meetup could be a great place to find in your local area. Facebook groups also really useful. In the UK and Ireland, we've got a lovely kind of initiative called Park Run. And it's very similar to that cult field experience you're talking about, where in pretty much every major town and city, they've got a park run. And so it's a community 5K every single Saturday at 9:30. And if you can run, you run it. And if you can't, then you walk it and you go with your dogs and your prams. What do you call them over there? Strollers? Kinderwagens,
Kinderwagen. Yeah, sure.
And that's great because, you know, you're outside, you're getting the therapeutic effects of sunlight, you're often in nature in a beautiful park, you've got the social aspect, and then, of course, you've got the exercise benefit as well, which is really, really beautiful.
Love it. Yeah, so I guess the one other thing we're looking at, I mean, we've sort of been informally talking about, believe it or not, Hugh and I actually outline content we want to cover before every pod. That part probably comes as a great surprise to many folks who join us. But we're now doing the section, I think, overcoming challenges and barriers to movement. So we talked about the fact that we need to be patient. If you've been sedentary, start low and slow, build to a bigger dose. We talked about the fact that exercise is unnatural. Right? None of our ancestors were lacing up their
tennis shoes.
Our remote ancestors. Running a 10K after tracking down some wild boar, it would have been ridiculous. But they were always ready to be moving, and sometimes moving really vigorously, in the service of meaningful goals. And so we need to lean into that idea. I've used this example before, but the average visitor to Walt Disney World, the Disney people tell us the average visitor walks 9 miles a day.
Nice.
Yeah. And
hunting and gathering for
exactly right.
Just joy, yeah. Abundant joy.
It's meaningful. They're not trying to get active, but they have to. And so to the degree that we can make the activity feel purposive. Now, one easy way to do that is to be doing it with a friend and to be like, oh, this is a time that I get to enjoy my friend's company, right? But there are all kinds of other ways. We can join a class where it's like, oh, I'm with this other group of people. I got to get through the class. We can simulate that experience with lots of videos. Many of them are freely available on YouTube. We just do a little bit of digging around. There are some phenomenal, maybe we'll link a couple in the show notes that we like. But whatever we can do, playing sports, something, make it game-like, make it a challenge. Whatever works for you, a recurring mantra that we're going to be saying probably another 100 times over the next couple of years is there is no one size fits all approach, right? What works for Hugh may not work for me. What works for me may not work for you. But if you're willing to just do a little bit of experimenting to figure out, okay, what is the best way to hack your motivational system to make it feel meaningful, to make it feel fun, to make it feel social, ideally, unless you're a very strong introvert, you're probably going to enjoy it a lot more if you have somebody else to do it with.
Absolutely. I guess one of the last things I'll say is one of the times in my life I've been the absolute fittest. And as a result, I use the word happiness in regards to struggle with the least mental health problems was whenever I worked as a bike messenger.
And Oh, nice. We
were doing maybe like 100 kilometers a day on the bike, like
wow,
probably about 1,000 calories, like that sort of work. And that just came so naturally because like it felt like a game and you were doing it for money. So there's that extra bit of meaning that maybe is missing from some of our exercise. And so just practically speaking, like I know a lot of us are looking for side hustles these days and we're looking to kind of find additional income to subsidize our main source. So there are kind of side hustles out there that involve your body. We were over in Germany there and we had a great time even just like picking some of the fruit that has been blossoming over the last few months. And it's pretty physical work. You're climbing up trees, you're crawling on ground. You can check out some of the food delivery apps in your city. And if you can do it on a bicycle, if you can stomach the city cycling, it's a really, really awesome way to stay fit. But there's tons of other ways. If you're into gardening work, it can be a really, really great way to kind of make money from your exercise as well, which I think is
landscaping,
unexplored kind of way to get this in as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, landscaping, gardening, all those kinds of things where you're outdoors, really pushing your body in ways that are meaningful, that have a little bit of a game-like element and super beneficial. So yeah, I mean, the bottom line, I guess we keep coming back to it, is whatever it takes for you to allow yourself to get this benefit. I mean, again, we all know that we need to be moving. We all know that movement is medicine on some level. We all know that it's good for us. So the ball game is not convincing ourselves that we need to do it. The ball game for most of us is finding a way to make it happen.
Absolutely.
It's finding a way. Now, the other thing, and we've talked about this a little bit before as well, is once we make it a habit, once it's a part of our lives, then it's a lot easier. We've got that momentum. So it's, I mean, exercise for Hugh, for me, is something that has been a long-standing habit. And so I don't have to use a lot of willpower, right? We all have a very, like a thimble full, a little tiny, tiny, tiny store of willpower. We get to spend it on something every day, but we don't have a lot of it. Because exercise is a habit for me, I don't have to use any willpower to exercise. I just do it because it's, my brain is like, oh, this is what we do. But if I were sedentary, then what I need to do is find a way to spend that little thimbleful of willpower on cultivating this habit, which, by the way, there's some really good research. Some listeners might have heard like, oh, well, if you do it 10 times, then now your brain knows that it's a habit. Anything you do 10 times. Or some people will say, well, 20 times. And guess what? The answer is some habits are acquired more quickly than others. And it turns out that exercise is one of the single most difficult and challenging things to make a habit.
Great news.
Hey, great news for everybody. For the average person, it's going to take probably between 20 and 40 times of doing it, 20 to 40 of your workouts to make your brain be like, oh, this is what we do. This is now self-sustaining. It takes zero willpower. So what that means is anything that you can do to get through those first 20 to 40 sessions, if that means a trainer, if that means a friend, if that means an app, if that means a class, if that means a group in your community, whatever gets you there.
That's really nice.
Once it's there, then you don't have to use your willpower anymore. I say that as the deepest form of encouragement to all of you, because we all know what it's like to struggle to do something that we know we should do and we can't make ourselves do it. And I just want to tell you, if somebody who was as sedentary as I was for a time in my early 20s, I was so out of shape. My blood pressure, Hugh, I'm going to tell you this. True story. I've never told anybody publicly this before. When I was 22, my blood pressure was already like 150 over 95.
I'm going to be honest, that means nothing to me. You got to like, how old are you like in blood pressure years with that reading?
Like an old man, like literally they should have been reaching for the medication pad.
Wow.
Like they start wanting to treat blood pressure that high. I would get winded. I would be sucking wind out of breath, walking up two flights of stairs. I wasn't unhealthy. I was just very sedentary.
Yeah.
Reading all the time. I'm a geek. I'm a bookworm. And it was like a come to Jesus sort of moment for me. Where a doctor is looking at me like, you're not aging very well. Like, and I was like, okay, there's no reason for me not to get physically fit. But it was a struggle. And so I guess I just want to say, if I can have that journey and now many decades later, just find it effortless because it's a habit, then nearly any of our listeners can do the same. And it's just going to be a matter of finding your own journey,
yeah,
your own path, your own activities that work for you.
Absolutely. And I love that because I think it's a very grace-filled way to end. And that's kind of the opposite of the exercise world. The exercise world is usually like screaming at people to try to get them to do stuff. But
yeah,
as you
absolutely.
Were speaking there, like our daughter is just about to turn 2 and we are really trying to like encourage her with her toothbrushing at the minute. And there's times where it's like kicking and screaming and like she really doesn't want to do it. And you go, okay. And you work your way through that. But like, I think exercise is kind of similar because it does just become like a matter of hygiene. You're like, oh, this is just something that I do. The same way like most of us wouldn't dream of like not going to bed before brushing our teeth. It just becomes so automatic. But I will also throw out there, if you haven't been shown or if someone hasn't come alongside you and instilled the value of brushing your teeth, I know people who they don't do it every single night because maybe they had something going on at home with their parents and that was just something that never happened. And so they've had to go on a journey to like make that part of their life and prioritize that. And I know for like so many people listening, exercise was just never prioritized in the home. Maybe your parents like never ever did it. Your community never ever did it, was never valued. And so like Steve and like myself, you're going to have to kind of like embark on that journey later in life, but you can still go on it. And as Steve says, like, it's just a matter of time. You get through those first, for me, call it 6 months. And I think like really, as long as you're not overtraining, as long as you're going slow, you learn to love it. And once you feel the benefits, like back to the Exerzac Steve talked about at the top of the episode, like once you taste how sweet the drug is of exercise, you'll not want to live without it. And so starting is the hardest bit, but we just really encourage you guys just to give it a go and get going.
I have nothing to add to that. That's beautifully said.
Beautiful. Patreon.com/mentalhealthpodcast is where you can support the show. We're getting a few patrons, Steve.
Hey, that's exciting.
It's happening. So like big, big thank you to all of you who have taken the decision to support us. Like we really, really appreciate it.
Did we mention this is a labor of love that we're not doing this to monetize it, but it does cost money to produce a podcast. It costs money to have a website. It costs money to do all of these things. And so we're just deeply, incredibly grateful to all of you who are joining with us. Whatever you can afford, if it's the cost of a mocha latte a month or something, I mean,
absolutely,
it really does make a difference.
It's a crowdfunded solution. You know, if you don't have the means to do so, please, the show will always be free. We love doing the show. You know, we do it because we care. We do it because we love it. We do it because we have too much fun when we hang out together. It's a great excuse to do that as well. But it really does. It goes a long way. We're on a bit of a journey here to try and break even. We've got a pretty strict timeline to do that. And so Patreon is the way that we've chosen to do that. You haven't heard any ads on the show. You haven't heard any sponsorship. That's very intentional. We both have quite strong opinions on that, about how kind of content should be monetized for the sake of editorial integrity and all that good stuff. So yeah, thank you so much to all of you who are supporting us. And if you've been thinking about it for a while, you've been listening to a few episodes, like go check it out. Check out the page. See if it's for you. And if it is for you, we'll see you on the other side. You can also get in touch with us on mentalhealth.fm. We have a little contact form. Please continue to send us your voice messages for our Q&A episodes. If you've been listening for a while, you will have heard we've got some awesome questions from you guys. I think we probably have like 5 or 6 more in the can that we need to get run. We need to do a Q&A session sometime soon, actually,
not
speak about it. But please keep sending them through because there's some really great even like follow-ups on episodes we've done before. It is the podcaster's way to turn this into a conversation rather than just like a monologue, for lack of a better term. So we make this show for you. We want to address things that are topical and relevant to you. The Q&A, the voice questions are our favorite way of doing that. If you're shy on the mic and you don't really feel like doing that, you can write us an email. We would really appreciate you writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. That's a great way as well. If you kind of want to hit 2 birds with 1 stone, write a review and slip in suggested topics going forward. That's a really great way where you could also support the show in a small but a really meaningful way. Steve, that's it. That's all I have to say.
Wow, this has been great. I love doing this. And thank you all for joining with us again today. And until next time, be well.
Peace out, guys.